Welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Delighted to have you with us today for some interesting weather week. My guest today, exclusive guest, is Tammy Flanagan. She's probably the world's best-known federal benefits expert, and Tammy has flown into Washington to be with us. We're pre-recording this show today, but she's going to be with us. And then today, Wednesday, you're doing a webinar for the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Is that right?
That's right, Mike. Yeah, thank you for having me on. We are doing a webinar this afternoon. That's
okay.
Right.
If people want to sign up for that, is it too late?
No, it isn't. It's going to be at 2 o'clock Eastern time, and you can just go to NARF, that's N as in National, A-R-F as in Frank, E.org, and right there on the home page, it'll say NARF Federal Benefits Institute. And if you're a NARF member, it's free. And if you're not a NARF member, why not? You can become one. And it'll be recorded there, and you can watch it more than once if you want to.
Well, good. I appreciate you sent me a copy of the presentation, the slideshow, and I based a lot of today's column on that information from you. So thanks for that. I think everybody knows when you're talking about the best date to retire, it's the best date that will work out for you. And probably at some point, a lot of people have spent some time at least looking at the calendar, trying to figure out when they'd like to retire, when they can afford to retire, which isn't always the same thing. And this could be a very different date. But is there a definition for the best date or the best dates to retire?
Well, there used to be, right, Mike? When you and I used to talk about this years ago, and we only had one retirement system for federal employees, it was so much easier because all you had to worry about was your civil service retirement check. And as long as you got that scheduled at the right date and the right time, you were good for the rest of your life. I think things have gotten a little more complicated now that FERS is in place, and we're seeing a lot of our current employees retiring under the FERS system. So now they have to coordinate not only that government pension benefit, but they also have Social Security to think about, and then what to do with all this money they've saved up in the TSP, because they probably need some of it to pay their bills every month.
And I know at one point, too, you could say pretty much that for one group of people, December 31st was a good date if you wanted to retire at the end of the year, or January 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, or the 1st, 2nd, 3rd of any month was the best date for the other group, correct?
Exactly. And I think it's always good to start with the basic government pension benefit, because that's where your health insurance comes from. That's how you continue your life insurance. And for many retirees, that's the major source of income in retirement, is that civil service retirement check, or even for our FERS employees, the FERS basic benefit. So the thing to remember is when we talk about this best date to retire, a couple of things. One is the commencing date of your retirement. That means what date will your retirement benefit start being paid? So as we talked about for many years now, the end of the year has always been that magic time of the year, because so many people want to save up their unused annual leave so that they can get paid in a lump sum payment for it. So by going out December 31st, which is pretty darn close to the end of the leave year typically ends early January, but if you go out December 31st, you'll get your first retirement payment for the month of January. Now, of course, it's not going to come until February, and even then it might be a couple more weeks down the road, but eventually it will be backdated to January, and then you'll go from there getting a monthly payment. Now, for CSRS employees, we always have said we can always look at the first, second, or third of the month. That way, under the old system, there's that grace period of being able to retire on one of the first 3 days of the month, and your retirement will still begin the next day. So if you went out January 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, which could be the holiday in there, your retirement would start the next day. So you would still be entitled to a January retirement check. But if you wait till the end of the leave year, which might be January 7th, then you're not going to get a retirement benefit until March 1st for the month of February. So that's typically why we don't say wait till January 7th to retire, because that will cost you 1 month worth of benefits.
Okay. Well, you know, I used to do, for a friend, I used to help out with retirement seminars, and I was not there as an expert in any way, shape, or form. I was sort of the comic relief. I was the guy there while they changed the scenery. But I used to tell everybody in the room, and these were people who were within 5 years of retirement, or at least 5 years of retirement eligibility, and I used to tell them, I said, just the very fact that you're in this room, you know, I don't know how your marriage worked out. I don't know if your kids wound up the way you wanted them to. I don't know if you live in the house you like, but the fact that you're sitting in this room and you persevered in a federal career long enough to be eligible to retire is absolutely brilliant move on your point, because so many Americans do not have any retirement plan. Or if they do, if they're lucky enough to have one, the vast majority don't. It's frozen at the time they retire, never goes up because of cost of living, and they don't have this thrift savings plan, which for the people under the FERS system, as you well know, entitles them to a 5% tax-deferred government pay raise, a match, if they put in at least 5%. And I think it's helpful for government workers sometimes to step back and look at it and say, I earned this. It's not a gift, but I'm pretty smart.
Exactly. After the TSP now has been around for close to 30 years, believe it or not.
Amazing.
And I think finally FERS employees are starting to lose that chip on their shoulder and finally starting to realize that they have something that's of great value, because when you add together the potential resource of the TSP plus your FERS retirement and lifetime insurance coverage and add that to Social Security, you have quite a nice retirement, and oftentimes at a pretty young age.
Right, and in the case of the federal benefit, and if they have Social Security, if they're under FERS, they're indexed to inflation in whole or in part.
Exactly, yeah, and that's another thing, like you said, with the private sector, those who do still have a pension benefit, very often it's a level payment for mm-hmm. life. So getting a cost of living adjustment in most years, and of course this year the retirees did not get a COLA, but in most years if there is inflation, if the price of gas goes up, they may get a cost of living mm-hmm. adjustment, which does help a lot over the years.
Yeah, we learned a lot about oil prices and deflation this last year and a half. I recall a friend at the newspaper I worked for, and he had been there for 30-plus years, but the newspaper had only had a pension plan for a couple of years. But he retired, and I think he told me his annuity was something like $141 a month.
Wow.
And, he had stock and things like that that he'd gotten lucky with, but that was it. I ran into him about 5 years later, and we were chatting about something, and I said, how much is your pension now? And he said, $141. You know, it had not changed and would not change and did not change.
That's like my uncle who retired from civil service retirement in 1978. And I think at the time his civil service retirement was about $11,000 a year. And Uncle Steve passed away in 2012, which was 34 years after he retired. Mm. And at that point, his retirement had tripled over that time. So it was now bringing in close to $3,000 a month and continued to do so even after his death, because it paid a survivor annuity to my aunt. So that's what we mean by cost of living. It's amazing the power of compounding, what that'll do to your retirement.
Well, I have two books in my office that I find very useful. One is the year 1995, and one is the year 1985. And it's one of those, the format says a loaf of bread was this, a new car cost this, average house payment was this. And if you look at what those prices were in 85, in 95, and look at them now, and you see what kind of projecting you're going to have to be doing. And I saw an obituary in the Washington Post, I believe it was January, a prominent civil servant, he had a very distinguished career. He died, and he worked to a ripe old age. He was in retirement for 34 years,
yep.
You know, as long as he
not
worked.
Not unusual. Not yeah. unusual.
In fact, in today's Federal Report column, there's two dates you need to know. One is when's the best date for you to retire, and the other one, which is a little tougher and a bit grim, is to know your expiration date. You know.
Well, if we knew that, it would yeah. be very easy to plan everything, but I think I'm with you. I don't think I want to know that
yeah.
date.
Yeah, I'll hold off on that. December and especially January are really popular months to retire with federal workers, and we've seen that the last few years with the statistics. All things being equal, if you want to retire at the end of the year or at the very beginning of the new year, there's a lot of things you can do to save yourself a lot of money, correct?
That's right, yeah. And, well, I have to preface this, because I have a friend of mine who's a financial planner in Alaska, Micah Shalansky, and I tell him this about, you know, this magic date at the end of the year, and he says no one in Anchorage would ever retire December 31st.
Yeah.
Because they have still, you know, 3 months of darkness ahead of them. But for the rest of us in the lower 48, the end of the year allows someone to maximize the payment for their annual leave. And back in the day, you know, when I started doing this and I met you, we only had civil service, and OPM was taking on average 2 to 3 months to process a retirement claim. And during that time, people got nothing. You just waited 2 or 3 months. So it was very hard to pay your bills with nothing coming in. Now, today, it's a little different. It still takes 2 to 3 months, but at least today you get an interim check. You'll get some benefits paid to you, so it kind of cushions that waiting period. But in the good old days, you had to rely on that lump sum annual leave check to hold you over. And even today, that's still a nice lump sum payment to receive, because in the last year you work, if you don't use your annual leave, and if you're in the 8-hour category, you can save up 208 hours and add that to what you carried over from the year before, which might be 240 hours. You know, you now have a lump sum cash payment for 448 hours times your hourly rate of pay, which is a significant sum of money to cash in and help, you know, do whatever you want to do with it for that first couple of months of retirement. So we do still see an awful lot of people who shoot for the end of the year, and the statistics at OPM show that we have a real heavy retirement process at the end of the year because of that. But I think that's the main reason, is those who are trying to cash in on their unused annual leave balance.
Right, and you don't want to have to tap your thrift savings plan unless you need it. You don't want to have to tap it unnecessarily just to tide you over while you're waiting for your first payment.
Correct? Exactly, because that money's never been taxed, and you run into all kinds of issues with taxes. So at least with the lump sum leave check, your payroll office will still do tax withholding for both federal and state tax, if you have to pay state tax, and also your FICA and Medicare tax will come out of that as well. Now, out of that lump sum check, you don't have to pay retirement, and you don't have to pay insurance benefits, and you can't contribute to the TSP. So there's a very limited number of withholdings that come out when you take that leave as a lump sum. So that's one of the reasons, in addition to just being able to max the amount, that people can do that.
Okay. There's a need to take a short break here. I'll be right back talking with Tammy Flanagan about the best date to retire for you. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Tammy Flanagan. She's a very well-known benefits expert. Tammy, the thrift savings plan, according to the data from the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, I think a majority of people, when they leave federal service, they retire or go to another job, take their money out of the TSP and give it to a financial planner or put it in an IRA or whatnot. Many of them want more freedom to be able to tap it. Many of them want more options for investing. But a lot of people who are familiar with the TSP, and this includes people like John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard and the godfather of indexed funds, Alan Roth from ARP and CBS Money Watch, all say you can't beat the thrift savings plan with a stick, the low fees and whatnot. Have you had some thoughts one way or the other?
Yeah, I think, and again, I think it's kind of like we hear, you know, what's everybody else doing? So maybe we should do what they're doing. Uh-huh. Or maybe, you know, Joe down the hall at the office, he seems to know about his money, so let's do whatever he's doing. And I think that we're not taking the time to really study it ourselves and learn the reasons why people move it out, or the reason why maybe I should leave it in. So as you said, there are some valid reasons for moving your money out of the thrift. If you wanted to invest it in other things besides the CFGS and the I fund, and you want to be more broadly diversified, well, you can do that outside of the thrift. But you got to balance that with the administrative expense that you're going to pay to do that. Whether you do it yourself or you pay someone else to do it for you, you're not going to beat that 29 cents per thousand per year, which is a very, very low administrative cost of the TSP. So you have to make sure you're going to make enough of a profit, I guess is the word I'd use, or, you know, make enough of a return on your investment is a better word, to make it worth doing that. And you're giving up the simplicity and on top of the low cost. So be real careful before you move everything out of the thrift. And also taxes. You know, we've talked about taxes a little bit, but when you take the money out of the thrift, if you don't directly transfer it to an IRA, you can end up in a pretty big tax problem. So, get some advice. You know, don't be afraid to learn more about that and make sure you're making a good decision.
Well, I think administrative fees are one of those things, and I know when I was younger and knew even less about finances than I do now, that would be such a boring subject for me, and I'd say, whatever, just pay the money and make me a lot of money, pay it. But when you look at it, I knew a guy who had been a cab driver in another city, and in order to drive his hack, he needed all kinds of signs and things like that. But every day when he came into work, he owed them $200.
Right.
And he had to make $200 before he could start making money. You know, he had to make $200 to break even. And I think about that with some of these fees or funds that have some tremendous returns sometimes, but they'll charge you 3 or 4%, and over time, that's a huge amount of money. That's how they make money.
Well, just to give you an idea, at 29 cents per thousand per year, a $500,000 TSP account is going to cost you $145 in administrative cost. If you're paying a financial advisor even a 1% fee, that's $5,000 a year. Compare that to $145, and I think that's pretty clear the difference in the administrative expense of using this huge volume TSP that really benefits from that wealth of the government, the size of the government, versus when you're doing it on your own. So you really have to make an excellent return to make it worth your while to move it out.
Well, I think it's also important for people to know, and people are suspicious of politicians and suspicious of Washington now, but members of Congress are in the TSP.
Mm-hmm.
Members of the high-level members of the executive branch are in the TSP, and they want it to work, and they want it to do well. And the Congress charged the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board they run this thing as inexpensively as you can, and we're going to oversight you like you wouldn't believe it.
Right. They are mandated by law to keep the expenses low, which is why, a lot of people say, well, why don't we have, 15 different funds to choose from? Well, anytime the TSP adds a new investment option, they really have to scrutinize what that's going to add to the administrative expense, let alone the complexity of managing an investment for, literally millions of people. So they've kept it simple, they've kept it low cost, and they kept it very efficient. So there's something to be said for it, especially when you're seeing people coming from private industry moving their 401k money into the TSP. They want to take advantage of that low cost and simplicity. So there's a reason for that.
That's a great point. The TSP now has a number of millionaires, and I think there's at least one account that's well over $2 million. And at first, when we were keeping tabs on the millionaires, of course, they won't tell you who they are, but they were all outsiders, as you said. A lot of them were very well, high-priced lawyers who came in to be federal judges. And these are smart people. These are smart men and women. They've been very successful in their careers. They come into government, and the first thing they do is look at the TSP versus their retirement plan at the law firm that they had. And they all put their money in the TSP, so that should tell you something. Now the TSP has a number of homegrown millionaires, people who did it the old-fashioned way. They invested the maximum, they took risks with the stock indexed funds, and there are a growing number of millionaires now.
Exactly. Yeah, I'll say that at my seminars, the fact that we have, TSP millionaires at this stage in the game, and usually at the break time, I'll get one person at least comes up to me and says, hey, I'm one of those millionaires. Don't tell the rest of the audience, but here's how I did it. And in the most case, it's because what they did was they put in this maximum, they maxed it out for their career, and they put it all in the stock funds, which is not advice, but it's the way that they did it. They didn't get afraid when the market went down, and they didn't jump ship when it went up. They just steady as the course, and so they had a plan and they stuck with it.
Well, I think that's another reason it's important not to confuse the date you're going to retire with the date you're going to start tapping your thrift savings plan account, because you can ride out the ups and downs of the market over a 20, 30, 40 year period, and when the market is down as it is now compared to some months ago, the way to look at it, if you can do that, is to think, I'm buying low. The shares that I would normally be buying every payday, they're on sale from where they were this time a year ago.
Right. Whether the market's high or the market's low, it's always a good time to buy. It's just a matter of picking a strategy for your future and for your career and staying with it without you know, trying to time the market or trying to follow what the current trend is and so forth. And the other thing is, too, when people leave federal service and they have this money in the TSP, then they have to decide what to do with it. And I think that's as hard to figure out as it was to figure out where to invest it. So now we need to start spending it. And so what are our options? Do we take a monthly payment? Do we buy an annuity? Do we just peck at it as we need it? And so forth. So I think people are struggling now with deciding, you know, how to spend the money and how to make best use of it in their retirement years.
I mean, I've heard other people talk about this, and they will say, for your sanity and your time in retirement, you don't just retire from something, you retire to something. Mm-hmm. What are they talking about there?
Well, it's your life after retirement. What's that going to look like? And I think for everyone it's different, and I don't think it's something you should beat yourself up over because, mm-hmm. you know, as you know, my husband retired. It's been a year now, so he's been on his retirement honeymoon, as I've called it, for this yeah. last year. And the dust is still settling, and, you know, we made a big move down to Florida, so that kept him busy for the better part of the year. And he's trying out different things. We're doing some volunteer work on the weekends, and since I'm still working, he's, you know, doing everything that needs to get done at home, which is very nice. So, you know, eventually he'll fit into that nice, even flow of retirement life. But I think a lot of people have a pretty strict plan. They want a real structured life, and for them that's fine. But if you want to be retired and spend time with your grandchildren, well, that's a good plan as well. So just, you know, think about that and give yourself some space that you don't have to decide all at once. It can take years to really figure out what retirement's going to look like.
Very good. Actually, I want to take a short break here at federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Tammy Flanagan. She's a very well-known benefits expert, and she is doing a webinar today with the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. And Tammy, again, how would people sign on for that, and what's the criteria?
Yeah, you can go right to the NARF website. That's the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, NARFE.org. And on the homepage, you'll see the NARF Federal Benefits Institute. Now, if you're a NARF member, you'll get that for free. And if you're not a NARF member, all you got to do is join up for a year, and you'll have a whole year's worth of webinars and a year's worth of NARF magazine, which is, as you and I both know, an excellent publication.
Maggie Carter does that, and it's really, you know, you don't normally say this about association magazines and things, but I look forward to it. People can retire anytime they choose, anytime they're eligible, but we were talking in the first half of the show about how many people, so many people choose December or January for mm-hmm. a variety of reasons. One of them is that they can carry over the maximum amount of unused annual leave and get paid for that, and you get paid at the higher rate. For instance, if federal workers get a 1.6% pay raise as projected in 2017, then 300 or 400 hours of your annual leave would be paid at the new higher rate, or the vast majority of it would be paid that higher rate. And that can be, the lump sum itself can be thousands of dollars, and mm-hmm. the pay raise could be hundreds or even $1,000, just the 1.6%.
That's right. Yeah. So the way that works is when you have to leave before the end of the leave year to be able to cash in more than the 240 hours. But when your payroll office cuts you the check, they have to project the value of the leave to what it would have been worth if you could have stayed on the payroll and used it up.
Ah.
So since that's going to carry you over to the new year, which is when the pay raise takes effect, all of that leave that would extend into, let's say, 2017 will get paid at that new higher rate.
Okay, and there's another flip side of this is just as good, and that is the annual leave, you'll be paid at the higher rate, at the 2017 rate, for most, if not all of it. And the other thing is, next year, when your taxes come due, that pretty good-sized chunk of money won't be taxable at a higher rate.
Well, it depends. Of course, mm-hmm. the reason why it depends is because some people will retire right into another career. So if you're going to have another full-time job and add to that, you know, 12 retirement checks plus an annual leave check, you might be paying a pretty high tax rate on that lump sum payout. But if you're going to be fully retired, Then, of course, that leave is going to be added to just your retirement income, which is probably less than what your salary was the year before. So you're right, it can be a tax break if you're not going to add too much more income to it.
Yeah, that's true, and that's a good problem to have. If you retire and go on to another job, then you're making money. So paying taxes is a good thing.
That's right. Sometimes
yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Tammy, it almost gets into the realm of a health guru here, but I think many people are not realistic about retirement. They don't think that they could be retired for 20 or 30 years. This is a fairly new phenomenon, both retirement and people living longer and all that. I mean, we don't think about it. But I guess one of the best ways to estimate your longevity is to, A, look at your parents, look at siblings maybe, look at how long they lived and what they did and maybe some of the things they did wrong, but also check out actuarial tables, huh?
Yeah, look at that. Consider your own health. And if you're part of a married couple, you even have a better chance that at least one of you will make it past 85. So don't underestimate your longevity, because I think a lot of people think, I only need to worry about the next 10 or 15 years. But in actuality, it could be 30 or 40 years. So be cognizant of the fact that you have to make that TSP last as long as you do. And when there's two of you, it could be a lot easier financially than when it's down to one of you. So also consider survivor options and what's going to be left behind for your spouse if you're married.
Oh, and I know I'm not a financial planner, certainly, and you aren't, but we've both dealt with many financial planners and listened to them. And a number of them have said that when you retire, don't be too conservative with your TSP. That is, don't park it all in something that barely makes anything, because over time, inflation will eat it up.
You still need growth. And I think a good way to look at that is if you look at the Thrift Savings Plan Life Cycle Fund, the L Income Fund. Mm-hmm. And that fund was designed to be used for people who are living in retirement, but yet it still has 15% of its balance in stock funds, in the S, the I, and the C fund. So even when you're living in retirement, you want to have some exposure to the stock market, because that's your place where over time, hopefully, you'll get some growth. And then you have your G fund for the majority of it, so that you have the safety. So I think it has to be a good balance between the two.
Yeah, and so many people, I think people learned this when the panic of 2008, the market dropped abruptly, even though they were a long way from retiring. Some people pulled all of their money into the G fund, and as it turned out, they wound up selling low, and then when they decide to come back in, if they ever do come back in the market, they will be buying high.
Just the exact opposite. Yeah, you don't have to be a financial planner to really put some common sense to that, to realize that's not the best way to do it. But it's emotionally the way we tend to react, because when things are going good and everything's going high, we all want to jump on that bandwagon. It's usually the worst time to do it.
Yeah,
you got to kind of predict that ahead of time, which is almost impossible to do.
Yeah, well, I've heard several different financial planners, and they express it differently, but they call it the sleep at night factor. And
right.
If you wake up in a cold or a warm sweat, bolt upright at 3 a.m. and say, what am I doing? That's a tough time.
Well, I always say, if you're not working with a financial professional, if you're not good at it yourself, then that's why you have life cycle funds, because they do it for you. They're rebalanced every day. They become diversified just a little bit more conservatively every 3 months. And you can leave your hands off of it and just pick a strategy, pick a target year, and stay with that throughout your career. And I think in the end, you might be happier and be able to sleep at night.
Well, I know some very sharp feds retired now, and they personally think the life cycle funds are too conservative. And the argument from the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board is that these funds were designed for federal retirees. Mm-hmm. So the assumption is that most of them will have Social Security, and that they will all have a government annuity, a guaranteed for life. In fact, life plus if you have a survivor.
Right.
But so that that's why they were designed to be conservative. But several of these people, rather than go into the current income fund, as you were talking about, they'd say, okay, well, I'll go to a 2020 fund or 2030.
And I've seen people do a combination of the two, which is absolutely fine, because if you're only 55 or 60, that's a pretty young age to be retiring. So to have it split maybe 50% in the L income, but maybe the other 50% split between the 2020, 2030, there's nothing wrong with that. You can make use of all the L funds if you want to. But what I also see oftentimes, which is again, an indication of someone who really is fearful and maybe not as well informed, is they'll put 50% in the G fund,
yeah,
and then they'll put the other 50% in the L income, and it's like you're defeating purpose of it.
Yeah, you've got too much G fund there, probably.
Right.
Well, the other thing, too, a mistake I think people frequently make, and we sometimes make it on the air just because we're not thinking about it, but when people talk about picking a fund like the year 2020 fund or the 2030 fund, that should mean that's within a couple of years of the, you know, one side or the other, that you're going to be retiring, or not retiring, but that's going to be when you're going
to
start needing the money. So your retirement age could be much sooner, and preferably should be much sooner than the age when you have to start tapping your TSP, correct?
Exactly. And you don't have to start touching it until you're over 70 and a half years old. And even then, it's not a big chunk that has to come out. So you really have to think through, you know, once you look at your basic government pension and if you have Social Security, what is that going to provide? Do you need another source of monthly income, or do you want this money to serve a different purpose? And I've even seen some people who want it to serve the purpose as an inheritance for someone else, which wouldn't necessarily be my intention, but a lot of people just don't need it. They've saved it up, and now they're saying, what do I do with it?
Tammy, we need to take a short break here. When we come back, I'd like to ask you to kind of give us a preview of what you're going to be doing for NARF and give a rundown here. We'll take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey talking with Tammy Flanagan, and she's talking about the best date or dates to retire and why. And now, Tammy, I can leave the room and go get a cup of coffee or something, but what are you going to be telling people when you do these rundowns? What do you tell them?
Well, today our title of our webinar is What is Your Best Retirement Date, with the emphasis on your, because as we've said throughout this hour, it's going to be different for everyone. You know, not everyone wants to save up their leave the last year that they work, and for some people having that lump sum is not necessarily the most important thing. So I want to go over both with the basic retirement benefit, whether it's CSRS or FERS, you know, what's the best date when you're thinking about all the different things that you have to think about as you plan to retire, and then add to that, what if you have Social Security eligibility, or is this a good time to take that, and then add to that your TSP. So it's almost like three gears working together. You're trying to really mesh the TSP with the FERS and the Social Security to make sure you're going to create enough retirement income that you can live comfortably and that you're retiring at the right time. You're not too early. You didn't wait too long. So we want to really time it out both financially as well as emotionally. I think there's something to be said for that. But we are going to talk about timing all three of those benefits, as well as CSRS included as well. But Social Security is another thing that a lot of people agonize over, because, you know, if you retire before you're 62, you can qualify and claim that benefit at age 62, but you're going to take a pretty big reduction of 25% to 30% for the rest of your life. So then do you wait till you're 66 or 67, or do you even wait until you're 70, where they had you a bonus of delayed credits for the rest of your life? And again, it goes back to that question none of us want to answer, is how long do you plan to live?
Yeah.
And then you would know for sure what to do.
Are there strategies for couples who are both going to get Social Security on their own? I mean, I've heard about one taking it and one waiting.
Exactly. Yeah, there's two very popular strategies that couples have been using in recent years, more so than ever before. And I think why these have become popular, at least in my humble opinion, is because we now have the freedom to delay Social Security because we have retirement savings and government pensions as well for federal employees. So they do give some thought to that. Should I delay it? Should I take it early? But unfortunately, late last year in 2015, these strategies are going to be coming to an end. So very few people going forward will get to use them the way that they have been used in recent years. But the one is called a restricted application. So for anybody who's going to be 62 years old before 2016, so in other words, you're already 62 right now, that would allow you to file an application for Social Security restricted to your spouse's work record. So if you're a married couple and you're over 66 years old, you can say, I'm going to let my Social Security benefit accumulate those delayed credits, which is up to a 32% increase if I wait till I'm 70, and I'll restrict my application to half of my spouse's Social Security. So I'll get something, but then I'll delay my own until 70 years old. So that one's available, but you have to already be 62 to use it. So again, if you're only 55, forget what I just said. That is coming to an end.
Yeah. Well, and an argument I've heard against that, too, and there's always an argument against everything, mm-hmm. is that the Social Security wasn't designed to make you rich, and it wasn't designed to let you sort of parlay it, get the most out of it. And what they're saying here is you've got obviously a fairly affluent couple, mm-hmm. and one is going to, you know, not take his or her benefit, but they will and let it accrue, but then they will wind up with a benefit that's 32% higher than had they taken it on time, when presumably for most people they need it. So that's sort of the counter argument.
Yeah, you're right. A lot of people don't have the choice or the luxury to delay Social Security. In other words, if you want to retire, you have to take it. Otherwise, I can't pay my bills. But on the other hand, if you are more affluent or if you have another source of income that you can fall back on, you're still taking a chance by doing that, because your bank on the fact you're going to live long enough to make it worth having waited. And that's the risk that everyone takes when they delay taking Social Security. Because, you know, how many people do you know never collected a dime of Social Security because they passed away before they mm-hmm. got the first check? So it goes both ways. And I think it's a shame that those strategies have ended, because it did give some people an option. But they're gone. They're going
right.
away soon.
Yeah, and they say it is a social welfare program, not an investing program. But
exactly.
Patty, I guess, and I know the stock answer is, when should you start planning for retirement? And it's the second day on the job or the first day on the job. Most people don't do that. But at some point, everybody should consider, you know, what's next. Is there a checklist or what do you tell people about it? What should they be doing, even if they're 15, 20 years out from retiring?
Well, I remember when we first started I do seminars with NITP, and I've been doing that for 30 years. And I remember in the early days, we would every once in a while get a younger person in there, you know, somebody forced them to go mm-hmm. in and say, hey, you better learn this when you're 22.
Yeah.
But today, I'm noticing we have entire classrooms full of 20-something and 30-something-year-old federal employees who have really learned that it's up to them, because they are very negative about the future of Social Security.
Yeah.
They really don't think it's going to be there, and they know that the government pension has been changing, and it may continue to change throughout their careers, and they may change careers. They may not end up in the government their whole time. So I'm really impressed to find out that a lot of our young people are starting to learn about their retirement, knowing what's the value of their federal career in terms of future benefits. So that's very encouraging. But if you're really starting that nuts and bolts planning of setting the date and trying to determine, you know, spousal benefit elections and that sort of thing, I would say you want to start that at least 5 years out. Because that's when I'll find people will not realize perhaps they need to have 5 years of federal health benefits or 5 years of life insurance. So if you catch them when they're at least 5 years away from retirement, we can fix that. But if they're planning to retire next month, you know, it's kind of a sad story to tell them, hey, by the way, you got to work 5 more years if you want to keep that health insurance. So I think 5 years ahead of time is the very latest that I would suggest planning, although, of course, it's never too late.
Right. Well, and in that 5-year rule, too, a lot of people think that they can't afford it. Maybe their spouse's private sector plan is better than the government plan. That's usually not the case. But if it is, they say, why should I have two policies? And the advice that the pros give them is just buy a simple, cheap government plan, buy the cheapest plan. You know, and what you're doing is you're buying insurance so that you can have insurance.
Exactly. Yeah, I just ran into that the other day. This man left federal service, got this wonderful second career that offered free health benefits for him and his wife. Mm. So he dropped that old federal plan, went with the company plan, and now that he's 65, he's going to continue working. But the company said, hey, buddy, you got to sign up for Medicare. And he found out because of his salary, Medicare is going to cost him to the tune of, you know, about $400 a month for him and his wife. Otherwise, they drop him from the health plan. So now he wants to get back in the federal plan, and unfortunately, that can't happen. He dropped out. He's done.
Yeah, I've run into a number of people over the years who had to work longer because of the 5-year rule. They didn't become aware of it until, you know,
I think people are getting more educated thanks to things like you and I have been doing, trying to educate people, but I still run across it. I still find people who weren't aware of that or had the wrong understanding of it and end up in that pitfall. You know, it's just a shame how many times that type of thing will happen.
Well, I know. I think it's funny. They told us we were moving to a paperless society, and now with emails and things, we're probably using more paper than we ever have. But are there documents, are there records, are there numbers that people should keep, even if they're in their 20s or 30s, and you know, put it in a folder and, you know, this is my retirement folder?
Yeah, well, today, like you said, we are getting a little more paperless. So with federal employees, your official personnel folder is now an electronic document. But I always tell employees, whether you're resigning or retiring, make a copy of that, whether you put it on a flash drive or print it out on paper, whatever you want to do. Make copies of those documents that actually document your career, show the beginning date, the ending date, what health plan you had, what your sick leave balance was, all those things that can come in handy when you file for retirement, when you might come back to federal service in the future perhaps, or even if you're applying for a different job. It's nice to have all that in front of you. It's very easy to put that down on a resume.
Well, you had a lot of people, too, and I would guess most of them are women simply because they have a baby, they have to leave federal service for a while. They may take their money out of the retirement fund, and then, although they never thought they would, they come back into government, and they learn they have to make repayments.
That's right, yep. You have service credit deposits for that type of thing where you may have taken a refund, or maybe you've served on active duty and you want to make a military service deposit. So if you've done that sort of thing, if you've paid those deposits, also be sure you've kept record of that, because sometimes it's hard to go back and find the record that you actually paid it or that you took the refund, and we forget over the years. You know, did we take a refund? You know, what did we do? So, yeah, the best person to keep track of your career is you. And if you expect your personnel office to do it, you're taking a chance, because, you know, you never know what's going to happen over the course of 30 years.
Of course, and particularly, too, if you jump around from different agencies, if you move geographically, it's much easier for you to keep those original documents than to go back 25 years later and say, yeah, can you find these for me? You really take control of your own destiny.
Yeah, and it's nice. Every once in a while, I'll talk to someone getting ready to retire, and they'll get themselves, you know, a 3-ring binder from the office supply store, and they'll have, you know, neatly stacked in there chronologically, sometimes even colored tabs of their federal career. And it's so easy to help them with their questions, because we can look right there and see what they've done and see if they were part-time or full-time or CSRS or FERS, where if you don't have those records, you're relying on your memory, and sometimes that'll fail us as years go in between our careers. So, yeah, I always say keep your personnel records. Same thing the agency keeps. I would keep my own copy.
Yeah. I always say, tell people, when you watch Judge Judy, the person that shows up with the most paperwork invariably wins.
That's right. Take a lesson from
Tammy. Tammy, thank you so much for being with us. I know you had a hazardous journey up here by airplane, but listen, we'll talk to you later, and thank you all for being with us here on Federal News Radio. Remember, our shows are archived, so you can listen to this one or any previous show at your leisure. So have a good week. Take care.